And good morning. Welcome to the old school. My name is Ross Miller, along with Dr. Stephen Bourgeois. Good morning, Dr. Bourgeois.
Good morning, Mr. Miller.
What's going on?
I don't know. I'm just kind of sitting here. We're trying out a new recording platform, and it's kind of fun. Our images are much smaller, almost like a thumbnail, and we both look a whole lot better. I don't understand it.
I think, yeah, I think the larger the image is, the worse it gets. It's like, it's, you know, our faces are not meant for highly pixelated, you know, or highly resolute images. I think we're better as thumbnails.
I think so. This is it's a turning point in our podcasting. And this may be the one. I just have a feeling.
All right. Well, and we're both listed by the same name. So it's kind of weird on the image, on the thing here. So,
oh, Stephen J and Stephen J. I like it. It's because we share an account. We share almost everything here, Miller, including our video accounts.
Well, speaking of new horizons, we have over the course of this podcast, we have discussed many things, many developments that have happened. Most recently, my retirement, but many other things we've discussed. Problems with raising a rather overly inquisitive daughter, for instance. But we are entering new territories. We are about to do our very first sell and buy of a house.
This is confusing. It's because you're in a house right now.
In a house right now.
That you bought.
That I bought. It was our first house. So we didn't have to worry about selling anything in conjunction with buying this house.
Double.
It was very much a cleaner process.
Okay, because before you were renting and then you just basically bought a house and packed up.
I was living that bachelor dream, that footloose and fancy dream of being in an apartment where nothing was really your responsibility. Someone else had to fix everything.
Ah, those halcyon days.
But now I am a homeowner and I'm about to be a 2-time homeowner. Because apparently we need more space. This family of three needs more space because it's about to become a family of five.
Something I haven't heard, Herr Miller, what's happening here? Are you having twins?
No, my friend, that ship has sailed. The sails have been clipped, as it were. So, no, that's not going to happen. Well,
we can clip that that little statement from our like.
No, but much like you went through, and that is the kind of the merging of the parental units into your current household. You do that with your father, I believe. And so my in-laws are coming, and they require their own space, of course. They want their own space. They assure us that their privacy and our privacy is of the utmost importance. And so we need to buy a house that's bigger and can hold five people, including a separate kind of an apartment. So we're buying this humongous house and we're carving out a piece of it on the ground floor for my in-laws.
That's really exciting that you're doing that and that you have the wherewithal to pull that off. Because it sounds expensive, you know, building an apartment within a house.
Oh, it's expensive.
Yeah.
So I think the first step is the idea of buying a house and talking numbers that you never thought you would ever talk about. And I think that was one of the biggest things that you, it's like, it was the biggest adjustment mentally is when you start dealing with a set of numbers that are so far and beyond what you ever thought you'd be able to do, but circumstances right now require that you do it.
It's hard to even remember what the, you know, our first house cost, but it's ridiculous. If only we would have stayed there, we would be free and clear, you know?
Well, I was going to ask you, how do you remember roughly roundabout? First of all, where was it? And what, how much do you think your first house cost?
I don't know. I would have to phone a friend on the cost, but it was in Benbrook, so south of us, you know, not far from, you know, where we both lived in Southwest Fort Worth.
Not an expensive area of the Metroplex.
Yeah, but I mean, but those homes were relatively small, and yeah, I mean, we liked it there, you know, but compared to that, I mean, we're probably four times that expensive now.
Well, I remember how much this house cost. I remember going into it. It was $140,000.
Which house? The one you're...
The house I'm in now.
Really?
Our very first house. And I remember at the time thinking, $140,000. I mean, just the numbers seem astronomical. It shouldn't have, really, in hindsight, when you consider how much I probably paid in total for all the apartments that I lived in the years previous. But you just don't think about it in those terms. But then it is a sphincter tightening kind of experience. The first time you sign a piece of paper saying that you're going to spend $140,000 and you're going to get a loan for this much money. Now, I was helped somewhat by the fact that I had a VA loan, and that helped as far as the kind of loan, interest, and whatever the case may be. And we're using the VA again, but it's still kind of a shocking notion. I remember at the time thinking to myself, good Lord, I've become an adult. Huh. I mean, did you equate adulthood with that first house purchase?
I don't think so. I had become a man much sooner, Herr Miller. there's something that connects you to the earth and to your community that is, it's sort of antithetical. I almost coined a new word, antithetical to our nature as wanderers. And I'm talking about the two of us, you know, so the idea of having an apartment, your lease is up and you're free. And that felt really good, but this is not that way. I guess it's not that hard to sell a house. So there's always an out, and also knowing that the price of that house is going up. So it's not as risky as you're making it sound. I don't think.
It's not risky, but it requires a level of logistics and legal and financial finagling,
right?
The likes of which seldom people come across.
Yeah, because nobody can actually afford a house. I mean, here's a drop down, you know, this amount of cash, and walk in, and it's my, you know, so you're not really buying a house. You're making payments through the bank. It's not that different from renting, technically. But then you're responsible for all the expenses, and that's the heavy part, I think, you know, is that the air conditioner goes out. We know about that. the roof, you know, needs to be repaired from hail. We know about that. We know about a lot of things, and those are all on your nickel.
They are, and I think it's not so much about buying a house to become an adult. It's about buying a house to do adult things, because, you know, there's a, you know, the idea of what an adult does. They work, they earn money, they have kids, they raise kids, hopefully correctly. They, you know, they buy a house. And so it wasn't so much the notion about being an adult, it was doing as adults, quote unquote, should do. Uh-huh. And so that first house was a bit of an eye opener. And you go through all the learning curves that you have to go through in owning that first house, as you said, fixing things or getting things fixed, but also renovation and things of that nature. And now you find yourself going through the process once more. When was the last time you bought a house? When did you buy that house?
It would have been my years are slipping by, I think 8 years ago.
8 years ago.
And, but don't quote me on it. I'm, because I have a fact checker who listens to the podcast, but I think 8 years ago.
So in the process, since you have a very accomplished, smart partner in life to kind of help balance the search, what was your contribution to buying a house? Were you the one that looked at the numbers? Were you the one that kind of looked at the house? Or did you just surrender everything to your very capable partner and just allowed you to kind of do other things? Or what was your role?
Well, you make it sound shady when you say partner. Or how about wife? Let's we were in our previous home for 12 years, and we just moved down the street. So same neighborhood, bigger house. I had a vision that when we suddenly our kids had a bunch of friends over, or a few friends, maybe two, but their parents were there, and I thought this is a little small. And so we moved down the road, but I don't know. You don't make these decisions by yourself. And I think I was, not definitely driving the details for sure. I'm not that detail oriented, and on the financial side, for somebody who runs a successful business, the personal finance and building a house is really intimidating.
It was a lot different, between running a business and then running your life. I mean, the margin for error is not quite as large, perhaps. But the thing is that for us, and Jen, my wife has known this for years, since she met me, and that is I have a very small attention span.
Sure.
Yes, I had to. There's coffee in my hand that I was covering my mouth with. You have a small attention span.
I have a small attention span. What my wife does, in an effort to try to maximize what attention span I have, is that she will call the realtor, very nice lady, the lady who helped us buy this house, who is being nice enough to help us on the next stage here. But, not nice enough. She's getting paid very well for us. But what my wife does is she will schedule 3 to 4 houses at a time. Uh-huh. And she will not do more than that, because she knows really 4 houses is pushing it. Because it's amazing the level of detail my wife manages to keep straight. We'll be driving, through here. I said, "Hey, you remember when we looked at a house in this neighborhood?" I was like, "No, I have no idea what you're talking about." And so she will kind of walk me through 3 to 4 houses max at a time. And my job basically is to give general impressions. One, do you like it? It's not bad. It's okay. Yeah, but do you love it? This is the thing I don't understand. My wife expects me to fall in love with a construction. I don't relate to houses in that way.
Well, that's your vernacular of saying it's not bad means it's really, really good. I mean, it's the same thing with food. It's not bad.
I'm not effusive.
No.
But I think you would think, we've been married for over 20 years, you would think my wife would be able to pick up on some of these subtle differences in tone and lingo. But it's just a question. I can't interact with the house the same way that she does. She's looking to fall in love. She's looking for that thunderbolt moment when the planets align and stars are in her eyes, and she thinks to herself, "I can't go another second without this house in my life." And I look at it and say, "Okay, yeah, it's nice. It works. It's serviceable." Sometimes, and here's the other problem. So many houses today are ugly. I mean, they're just not very interesting to look at. The inside could be interesting because that tends to show more of the person's personality, how they constructed or how they built it in the first place. But it's tough to try to settle on a place when you don't have strong emotions attached to it.
Well, it's a little bit different now because you know, before you were working during the day, leaving the home, coming back at the end of the day. Actually, both of you were, but you're going to be spending, you personally, a lot more time in that house. Mm. You know, pretty much every waking hour, unless you're out gallivanting or causing trouble. So there are some things. I'm sure you're looking at these rooms and thinking, this room can be this, this room can be that. Here's where I'll hang my signed jersey from the Bundesliga or something like that. So that had to be fun.
Well, it's the imagining can be fun. I think our situation is more complicated in that we are also trying to imagine how to carve out an apartment for my in-laws. You know, is there a string of houses? Is there a string of rooms in a certain part of the house that can be, you know, put together, basically gutted and recreated as kind of an apartment, so that it gives my in-laws everything they need and want, and makes them comfortable. You know, the problem is it can't be too big because it's an apartment inside of a house. And so by definition, we're talking about 500, 600 square feet, something along those lines. But so that's been a big part of that. And my wife, who has worked with the Federal Aviation Administration, part of what she used to do was she used to do real estate. And so she seems to have a mindset and an eye for how things kind of connect. Now I can figure that out in kind of a general sense, but you know, she has a better eye for that sort of thing. What I find interesting is it's just the notion of walking through someone's house. I don't know if you remember the sensation, but do you remember the notion of walking, you know, we're not talking about a house that's empty and the people have already moved out, but people are trying to sell their house and they're still in their house.
Their stuff is in there, but not them personally. Because you know, normally when there's a tour, they ask you to vacate,
get out of Dodge.
Yeah, definitely, it's a best practice. I mean, you're about to see the flip side of that. I think it's more telling, the idea of some strange people walking through your own home, judgmentally looking at everything, and you know. That's more traumatic, I think. You know, the idea of somebody in your space. But I mean, many of the homes are staged anymore, and so it's really not their stuff anyway. And it looks immaculate, or it's gutted, meaning they've moved and there's nothing in there. That's actually maybe the best way to view a home. You can see everything, see the nuts and bolts, but not the window dressing. But I think you'll find it even more, I guess, unsettling when it's your home. And then when you're moving out, it's sort of strange. And I've experienced that, and I experienced it with my father's home back in Oregon when he moved to, you mentioned that he moved in with us for a year. But that I have some pictures of that. And it was really traumatic in a way to see that living room. And I have a picture of him standing in the living room and there's nothing there. You know, where a whole life happened for, you know, 30 years or more, you know, more really longer. So there's a lot ahead, but I think the, you know, your side of things is going to be, you know, I'm interested what you have to say about that.
I remember, there's a musician by the name of Trent Reznor. He was the lead singer of Nine Inch Nails, and he wrote a song called Hurt. And Johnny Cash famously did a remake of it that basically overshadowed the original song. And I remember an interview with Reznor saying that, you know, one of the things that I had to come to grips with is that it was no longer my song. You know, that was my baby. He said, I remember the emotions I felt when I was writing it, the experiences I was going through. But you have to succumb to the idea that it no longer belongs to you. And I've heard other artists talk about this, that once you paint something or create something and then you put it out into the world, it no longer belongs to you. Now, intellectually, you can come to grips with that idea. It's understandable. But emotionally, that's a different ballgame altogether. You know, I said that I don't get emotionally attached to buildings when I'm kind of walking through them. but haven't been here in this house for 15 years, it's a different story. I like this house. I'm comfortable here. I've created and carved out, you know, through renovation, through furnishings, through color on the wall, or whatever the case may be, something that I feel comfortable in. And so the notion of strangers coming in, as you said, silently or not, judging, it's a strange feeling. I'm not hurt by it. It's just strange.
So you're not going to be there following them around, pointing out little things.
Here's the thing. And they told us this. Our realtor told us this. In houses nowadays, there are various devices that were not put there for any kind of nefarious purpose, but they do have the ability to record conversations. Now, she was very keen to point this out with regards to the camera doorbell thingy, that picks up on all conversations, and the seller can hear that conversation going on. So she talked about the idea, especially coming up on the front door. Don't say anything, you know, because then you're talking about potentially having information that might help in the negotiations for the price and things of that nature.
That's devious. You can get up there and say, hey, this place really sucks. I've never seen such an ugly house. Go through a whole shtick, you know? and then going, okay, let's go inside with, you know, just because we're here, but we're
just in here. Might as well.
And then you're negotiating from the beginning. I love it.
It calls to question notions of privacy, which we could talk about at a later time, but you know, the idea that someone can do that, and I don't know how many people know about that, but this is an element that we now are confronted with while looking for houses, is the notion that there are 50 things in the house that could probably record your voice.
Wow. So you're saying inside too, which makes perfect sense. So you do a tour in silence, stoically, because they're also videotaping you, sound and video. So you just don't say anything, keep your eyes straight ahead, no communication, and there you walk out.
It's that obviously you can't do that because you're trying to envision yourself in a place, and so therefore there has to be some sort of conversation at the time. As you look at what will we use this room for, as you mentioned, what we use that room for, how do we carve out an apartment, that sort of thing. But it's just a strange extra element. Now, my concerns when I bought my first house back in 2008, 2009, whatever it was, there was this idea of, you know, how do you evaluate a house? You know, it's interesting. Nowadays, if a house is newer than, say, 2000, 2005, now you have bedrooms that are like, especially the master bedroom, is like palatial. And it's almost like a spa retreat. You know, the bathroom has got all these bells and whistles and all this other stuff. If it's prior to 2005, and our house that I'm in now was built in 89, everything is small. I mean, we have a fairly large master bedroom, but and the bathroom is fine. The closet is minuscule. And so, but you can't really do anything about that. So someone's either going to like the charm of the place outside of the closet space or they're not going to. But one of the things that I remember being hampered by was years of watching HDTV and watching all these punk kids going into $500,000 houses when I'm looking at $140,000 house. It's just all their demands and their silly comments and what have you. And that colored how I kind of looked at a house rather subconsciously. Now, you know, as a homeowner, you look at things differently.
So as a person who's buying and selling, you know, which side, where's the stress on buying or selling?
Buying. Mainly because, I mean, we bought this house for 140. It has done quite well in the appreciation department as far as the value of the house goes. So that is fine. But It's the notion of buying the house and then going through the construction process of creating the apartment for my lovely in-laws. That's where you get into potential problems. Now, it has been said that this is a new trend, that we're on the front end of a new trend of multi-generational housing.
Yeah, and some of them are set up. I mean, when my father moved in with us, he was in the master suite, which my wife is saintly for offering that. But it was perfect because he was self-contained and he spent a lot of time in there. But he would come out and we ate together. And so it was definitely we didn't separate, you know, like, but having two people or, you know, in-laws, I could see the idea of that separation. And so the investment you're putting in is really helpful for sustainability for the group to be able to function. And like me, you like your privacy.
Yes. I think it's going to be interesting how it works in reality. I mean, my in-laws are very nice people. I don't have nearly the issues that sometimes you hear horror stories about, you know, they're lovely people. And they, like, you know, stoic Midwesterners from the land, you know, they have this notion that they just want to be on their own and they want us to be able to be on our own. It is strange. It will be strange being in a house knowing that there's another unit in the house somewhere and that you're not actively seeking communication with them on a 24-hour basis. And I think it's going to be strange just to find that balance. They say they want privacy. They say they want us to have our privacy. In reality, what is that going to look like? I'm not sure. Because, you know, are they going to come over more than they thought they were going to? More than we thought they were going to? You know, is my kid going to be visiting their grandparents her grandparents on a regular basis more than they want to? It's going to be an interesting dynamic. I'm not sure how it's going to play out. And I think that adds to... Stress might not be the right word. I don't feel stress so much as I feel uncertainty, and maybe that's stress by another name.
It stressed me.
But I don't know if you, I mean, did you really have conversations with your father prior to about what that would look like, or did it just happen organically? I got a feeling that's what's going to happen with me.
Yeah, no, this happened pretty quickly. We knew it was time. For him to, I mean, we probably got really lucky how long, you know, he was, I guess, 89. Mm-hmm. Yeah. When he moved in with us and he was there for almost a year and when he passed away. But it was, you know, we talked about it and did it, but there wasn't that, I mean, but having somebody older is different. I mean, your in-laws, you know, are going to be around for a long time. So this is a big deal, but I think a different scenario, and particularly with two of them, it just feels a little bit different.
What's also interesting, so I have friends in Germany, as you do. I have friends in Ecuador. I don't think you do in Ecuador, but we both have our share of international friends. And what's interesting is that in every single case, they talk about how much more difficult it is to buy a house in their respective countries compared to here. Here you go to realtor.com, you look, you know, you go, we're not here trying to sell realtor.com. Although if you're interested, realtor.com, we could
like a free app.
Yeah.
I mean, it's just free. There's nothing, there's no profit that they're making. I don't know why they even do it, but it sure helps. It's like a pastime, you know,
yes. Where we live most. And so for us, it's a very easy process. There's a lot of things in place that makes it easier. But talking to my friends in Germany, I mean, talking to my friends in Ecuador, it's just, there seems to be a lot of governmental rigmarole that makes this a much more difficult process than it is here. What's also interesting to talk to my friends is the difference between what's considered appropriate for an American house as opposed to what is considered appropriate and possible in a German house. One of the things my German friend mentioned was that the notion of these wide open spaces in a house, this open floor plan, you know, a nice flow, you know, not that we're looking for feng shui, but if it works and if it happens to fit, I'm all for it, you know. But all these things are designed, they're design features that seem to be unique to the United States.
Particularly recently. I mean, some of the older homes, 1950s, particularly 60s, were maybe closer to the European homes, where, I mean, they have no flow at all. They just have separate rooms, you know, with doors and maybe this hallway in between. So there's not the idea that you're all living in one home, one space at the same time. And I think we take that a little too far with these open plans. So, I mean, right now, everybody in our home can hear this podcast, even that room with the door closed, because it's an open. So be careful what you say, Ross.
Exactly. Okay. Yes, I will.
Actually, my wife listens to the podcast. She's listening right now live. So she doesn't need to, because she can hear it perfectly. Apparently, I project pretty well, as do you. there's no problem, but the floor plans we're used to that. We want to be able to be in the kitchen and watch TV, you know, at the same time while the sports are on, and that's a flow idea. So that you're cooking and you're all people are walking. It's like we've created party homes. That's what we have. They're perfect for parties.
And that's what people talk about. They're like, oh, I want to be in the kitchen, but I want to be able to talk to my friends. And I'm like,
yeah,
that happens, what, 4 times a year? What are we talking about here? That you get friends over.
Y'all are social butterflies. You entertain more than anybody I know.
To call us social butterflies perhaps is not the best choice of words. My wife is probably more the social butterfly than I am.
No, you all have dinner parties. It's a dying art to have people over. And
we do enjoy that. But so that's one thing you have to kind of get your head around is just how houses are done nowadays. I think one of the things that I try to avoid. There's several things I tried to avoid. One, I tried to avoid the neighborhoods where the houses were like 2 feet apart. And I don't know if in geography terms, in cultural terms, you know, sometimes we'll talk about people going into old neighborhoods and creating what they call McMansions, where they basically take up every square inch of a lot with a house. And there's actually many cities that have kind of pass laws against doing that. You have to have a certain percentage of your lot house free in order for you to be able to build something on a pre-designed plot of land. So that's one thing, you know, the fact that houses being so close together, you know, the color of bricks or whatever, you know, those kind of things can be an issue. I just, you know, I also wanted space. You know, in conjunction with the idea of not wanting to be 2 feet away from the next house, I wanted this sense of space. It's going to be interesting to see how this turns out. We've put an offer in a house. It's got a green space across the street from us that kind of gives a sense of space. We were looking at another house that kind of butted up against a golf course. That was kind of nice, you know, even though I'm not a big golfer, I could appreciate the grass and the trees and what have you. But that's hard to find. And I think it creates kind of a claustrophobic feel that I don't jive with too well.
You don't like being cooped up like you used to in faculty meetings. You would get a little bit antsy. but it is funny. We spend all this money on a house and we're basically putting ourselves in, you know, in a type of a prison in a good way, you know, a nice one. It's blocking us from nature. And imagine having a small house on a big plot of land, you know, different experience, you know, where the outdoors is part of your life. And I'm guessing that this, well, I've seen pictures of it. So I know that the backyard potential is incredible. You know, it's what you're looking at.
You know, what's best about the potential of this house that we put an offer in for is the creation of the backyard office.
Excuse me?
The backyard office.
You mean a hut?
A hut.
You're building a, you and I are both building huts.
We're going to build your hut first.
We've never mentioned the hut publicly. but you have a place ready out there with enough room to build the hut.
So there's a shed out there now that apparently has electricity already run out to it.
Yeah.
So that's the big thing right off the bat. Right. Now the shed itself is perhaps a little bit too small. It needs to be perhaps a little bit wider, but the notion of having that place, and it's interesting that, you know, you talk about some of the developments that you start to see in houses nowadays. I wonder if that's going to be the next thing. Is some sort of structure in the backyard that's used as kind of like either an office, a man cave, a she shed, whatever the hell they're calling those things nowadays, or, you know.
I think we're reading too much into our own eccentricities. You know, we want a hut that's, you know, that where the roof goes into the earth and it's a bit rustic, and there's no technology except for that electricity. There will be no internet. Any furniture is circa 1970, and it's there to read and write. So I don't think that too many people are going to do that. I mean, they might turn it into a place with TVs and hot tubs and all of that, but we're interested in a more Spartan type hut out there, you know, where we can walk through a clearing and then have a non-technological experience.
So 70s decor has basically become IKEA modern. So you just go to IKEA, just buy your various, couches with four skinny legs on it, and just the table that's just basically what looks like one of those old U.S. Army tent tables, you know, that they used to have mats spread out upon, you know, and that's basically what you have. And so I imagine the only bit of technology I'll have is a radio in the room, but the idea of a desk area and then a bookcase area, sitting area to read. You got to have the electricity also, because you have to run the little individual room AC unit in there.
AC and heat, yeah. That, without that, you couldn't even walk into a hut in Texas.
And it would be, if I lived in a colder climate, it would have a potbelly stove kind of a thing.
Oh, that would be fun. That would make it feel more like the Black Forest.
But it just doesn't get that cold here.
Unfortunately.
Very rarely. So I got plenty of plans. I got plenty of ideas. I have vision, and the rest of the world wears bifocals. So I got all these ideas. It remains to be seen what will become of it. Perhaps by the time we record the next podcast, you know, I will be the owner of, well, probably at that point, two houses, trying to get rid of the second one, the first one. But this could be a big step.
Really is. And you're taking all the steps, you know, and it seems, I mean, you've been talking about this, and I know it's not just something that happened, you know, a few weeks ago. I mean, I'll have been planning this, having conversations, and so I'm excited, and I always like coming to your house and sitting down in the same place, drinking the same beer often, and sampling your incredible selections of libations there. but it's going to be different, you know.
It's going to be different, especially in the short term, because for whatever reason they've got tile all over this house. We got to get some of that tile out of there and put some wood floors, nice comforting wood floors.
Okay, well,
we'll see.
I guess we're not going totally 1970s, but if I had my druthers, I would get 1970s paneling everywhere and have shag carpeting, because it helps me hear better. You know, the thing about hardwood floors, for those of us with, you know, not great hearing, is you can't hear shit. Did I say? You really can't.
You can't, although I can't abide by shag carpeting. I'm not willing to go as far as you are with the 70s decor. The next thing I expect to hear from you is, you know, having like a like one of those little plush paintings of the dogs playing poker or something like that.
Come on. There's one guy is holding a card. He's cheating. It's really cool. You can't be.
Or in one house I saw a kind of a crushed velvet painting of Jimi Hendrix.
Oh. Why not?
God bless him. I mean, it stuck with me. That was like 30 years ago. I think I saw that, but I mean, that sticks with you. So maybe there's something to it, but I can't do it. I think I'm going to go more the modern route.
Okay. We're not going to replicate our past with our poster of Farrah Fawcett on the wall.
I had that poster.
Yeah.
Like most kids my age, I had that poster. So.
Okay. We've from house building now here, Miller, somehow.
I don't know. We've devolved to be sure. But anyway, should be an interesting time. And I think we've beaten this topic down.
We definitely have.
But maybe we'll revisit it when we start building the offices and the huts in the backyard. Because for me, I've always wanted to build something from scratch. And I have a fairly good idea of how to build something like this. And yeah. So this is what happens when you watch all those YouTube videos of people renovating chateaus or something along those lines. But
you need to do it. You have the skills, and ideally it's built from trees from your property, from your land, which is probably not realistic.
I got a quarter of an acre.
Right. But we can do one of our famous remote episodes, just like when we were traveling through Switzerland. We can do one when we're building our two sheds in our respective backyards.
Could be. We'll have to wait and see. Well, it's a rainy Saturday, but perhaps something can still get done. At that point, we have a couple things coming up. We have the ministers. They're coming up. We're going to be doing an episode here in the next month or so about religion, the state of religion.
Oh, ministers. Okay.
What do you think of
that? I'm on my best behavior, and we might have to delete that S-bomb I dropped.
Can't say shit in front of the pastors.
Come on here. I'm going on.
Say again?
It's not going to go well, I can tell you right now.
No. And also, we have a tentative scheduling of a professor of political science at Texas Christian University. We'll be talking about China and talking about geopolitical things, what have you. We don't talk about our politics, but we're going to talk about other people's politics and kind of like forces that are happening in East Asia. So that should be fun. She also was amenable to the idea of talking about education in China, which I thought might be kind of cool to look at and compare to what's happening here. So a lot coming up. And of course, a few shows with the two of us bantering about stuff that may or may not be interesting, but
whatever comes to our mind, freestyle.
Well, so I just say adieu, Herr Dr. Bourgeois.
Auf Wiedersehen, Herr Miller.